From PRI, Public Radio International, and KCRW Santa Monica, this is To the Point.
Can Barack Obama enrich ties with India? Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. Indians had a love affair with Bill Clinton. George Bush treated India like an international partner. Barack Obama has been complaining about outsourcing American jobs. On top of that, the U.S. president has timed his arrival during the biggest commercial holiday of the year, and shops are closed because of security. India is an international player. Today we'll hear about trade and diplomacy, about India's relationships with Pakistan and China. We'll also hear about coconuts and monkeys. On Reporter's Notebook later on, the genome and personalized medicine. First, here's the news.
Support for To the Point comes from subscribers of KCRW Santa Monica and from the Public Radio International Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation, the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, and the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world, uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Hello again, Marvin Alney, back with To the Point. When President Obama arrives in India, he'll find a country growing four times faster than the U.S. and relishing its new role as an international competitor. We'll look at the challenges and possible benefits of his visits to Mumbai and Delhi. On Reporter's Notebook, 10 years ago, two human genomes had been sequenced at the cost of $2 billion. By the end of next year, it'll be 30,000, and the cost is dropping toward 1,000 each. We'll find out what that means for the revolution called personalized medicine. First, this news update. Unemployment was a major issue in this week's election. Here's what President Obama had to say today.
Today, we received some encouraging news. Based on today's jobs report, we've now seen private sector job growth for 10 straight months. That means that since January, the private sector has added 1.1 million jobs.
Dan Gross is columnist and economics editor at Yahoo Finance. Good to have you on our program, as always.
Good to be here.
So there's a net gain in jobs. More were created than lost. It's the first time that's happened since May, but the unemployment rate is unchanged. Why?
Well, the unemployment reports tell us two different things. One is the number of jobs on payrolls, that's the establishment survey. They call up companies and say, how many people do you have working? And that's where we get this number. You know, we added 100,000 jobs, we lost 50,000 jobs. And then there's a thing called the household survey where they call people at their homes and say, are you working? Are you looking for work, et cetera? And that's how they determine the unemployment rate. And it's done as a function of the number of people who say they are in the workforce. So if a lot of people just decide, you know what, I've given up work, I'm giving up looking for work, I'm so frustrated, I'm not even in the workforce anymore, and you had the same number of jobs, the unemployment rate would fall. So, you know, the unemployment rate, that 9.6% number that's stubbornly high, is likely to remain so even as new jobs are added to payrolls, because when jobs become more plentiful, more people kind of get off the sidelines and say, you know what, I'm back in the job market now.
Of course, there's so many figures available that the president can pick one. The private sector has added 1.1 million jobs since January, and to make things sound much better, perhaps, than they really are.
Well, you can pick numbers, but, of course, that is the big one. If you look through the figures on payroll jobs are what people want. Those are the jobs that get a regular paycheck and that have benefits and paid vacation. There are about 131 million of them in the country. And the private sector accounts for about 83% of them. So that is really where you need to see growth in order for the labor market to improve. And, you know, one of the things when you delve into this, we all talk about how government spending is way up and stimulus. The reality is that government employment has been steadily falling for the last many months as state and local governments cut jobs, as those temporary census government workers were laid off. So you dial back a year ago, and I ran these numbers, government jobs accounted for about 17.4% of all the payroll jobs in the U.S. This month, because of that cut in government jobs and because of the steady increase in private sector jobs, it's down to 17%. So I think, you know, you can make the case that there has been a steady underlying improvement in private sector job growth, not at a pace that is satisfying given how many millions of jobs we lost, but you have to walk before you can run.
Interesting that you made that point about government employment falling, the size of government being such an issue in the campaign. Not only is that true because census workers have been dropped by the federal government, but also states and cities are cutting back, aren't they?
Absolutely. You know, the government spending is up because there's more spending on things like food stamps and unemployment insurance and bailouts, not because there are more spending on salaries of civil servants. And what we've seen is if the federal government was acting like a Keynesian, you know, expanding spending and cutting taxes during the recession, in the states you had 50 little Herbert Hoovers, and in the cities another several thousand who, because they are not allowed to run deficits in the middle of these bad times, are raising taxes, property taxes, sales taxes, income taxes, you name it, and cutting jobs wherever they can. And, you know, so there is much more state and local government than there is a federal government. So that's why we're seeing that.
You're a columnist and economics editor at Yahoo Finance. You have to wonder if had people known this information, it might have made a difference on Tuesday.
I mean, if people hadn't been lying about the fact that candidates had been telling the truth about what's really going on in their economy, I've, you know, long since lost hope that campaign season is a time for accurate and dispassionate discussion of what's really going on in the jobs market.
Does this put to rest the idea that there will be a double-dip recession?
Well, I think this is another nail in a coffin that had already long since been nailed shut. And again, the reality is that the pace of economic growth is not satisfying because in the end of 08, the beginning of 09, we were shrinking at a 6% annual rate, which is something we haven't seen. I don't know how old you are, Warren, but it's something I'm guessing we neither one of us has seen in our lifetime. That downdraft was so sharp and so swift that you need a really fast bounce back to get back to, you know, what it felt like in 06 and 07. But the data flow, since the economy began expanding in June, July 09, has never come close to being back in negative territory.
Okay. Unfortunately, that's all the time we have. Dan Gross with Yahoo Finance, as always. Thanks a lot for being on our program.
Right.
In a moment, can President Obama enrich ties with India? To the point.
To the Point thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com. With news and information from 10,000 global sources, Factiva is a resource for companies whose continued success rests upon timely strategic news on their industry, competitors, and themselves.
Warman Olney back with To the Point. With a contingent including 250 business leaders and the Secretary of Commerce, President Obama will arrive in India tomorrow just after Diwali, India's biggest holiday of the year. Tinku Ray is based in Delhi for the BBC, where she hosts the program World Briefing. And Tinku Ray, it's always good to have you on our program. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you, Warren. It's great to be here.
The president will be in Delhi, where you are, on Monday. He's going to address a joint session of Parliament. He's going to arrive in Mumbai. Tell us what's so important about Diwali.
Well, Warren, I don't know if you can hear behind me. There are firecrackers and fireworks going off. And they've been going off for hours now. I mean, we're talking about thousands and thousands of dollars worth of fireworks going up in smoke. This is the biggest Hindu celebration of the year. And people all over the country are letting off fireworks, giving sweets as gifts, and they're having a really good time, basically. It's a great holiday. It's been sort of going on for days now, and it'll probably go on for over the weekend, although today is actually Diwali. So, you know, President Obama is arriving at a very, very auspicious time for the country. And I think a lot of people are hoping that this trip will be a really fruitful one for both sides.
Not very auspicious, though, as I understand it, for the merchants who expect enormous sales at this time, but they're having to close down a lot of stores because of security.
That's right, Warren. This is mainly in Mumbai, where the president arrives tomorrow, and it has been a little bit unfortunate because this is the time of the year when a lot of the street vendors and businessmen make up their year's profits, basically, because there's a lot of shopping going on. It's the equivalent to Christmas here. So they've been shut down because of this huge security arrangement that's been put in place in especially South Mumbai, where the president will be staying. He'll be staying at the Taj Hotel, which many people may remember was one of the scenes of the attacks which happened back in 2008. So he'll be staying there. He'll be traveling around in that area. He'll be meeting a lot of people. He'll be having, he'll be giving speeches. So, yes, some people are not very happy with that. The Mumbaikers are not allowed to set off firecrackers as well at the moment. It's going to cause a huge security problem. So, a little bit unhappy there.
Will this be seen as insensitive on the part of the president?
I don't think so. I mean, I think it's expected that, a visit of this magnitude, the President of the United States coming to India, I think people expected it would happen. I think they did think that it might be a little bit of an overreaction by the security guards and the intelligence people that have come into the country to make sure that everything's safe. But you can never take any chances, really, on these kind of visits.
Tell us about the coconuts in Mumbai and the monkeys in Delhi.
Yes, I'm afraid a few little quirky stories. I mean, the president is expected to go and visit the museum for Mahatma Gandhi, the father of the nation. He's an inspiration, as the president has mentioned before. He's one of his inspirations. He's obviously a well-revered and very loved man here as well in India. And, the museum is surrounded by coconut trees, and there was a little bit of a worry that maybe a coconut would fall and hit the president, so they've cut all the coconuts down. Another worry in Delhi is we have roaming monkeys, wild monkeys that just roam the city, and they cause havoc, and they get into offices and homes as well. I've had a couple sort of sitting on my doorstep as well. And they're building walls to try and prevent them coming anywhere close to the hotel where the president will be staying in Delhi. So a few little quirky things that are happening as well.
Are the monkeys aggressive?
They are. They can be very aggressive. They can, they attack. They have attacked people. They bite. They scratch. And if there's a whole group of them, they can be very, very intimidating.
What is it that India hopes most to get out of this visit?
I think, Warren, India really does feel that it's got the upper hand in this relationship today. I mean, India has seen a phenomenal amount of growth in the past decade or so. And, the last growth rate that the country posted in August was 8.8%. And it really has been largely unaffected by the global financial meltdown, so to speak. It
hasn't 2% in the United States, I should say. Go ahead.
Exactly. I mean, that's the thing. I think this comparison there, and it isn't lost on Indians, basically. They think, there is a lot of money here. There's a lot of buying power. And I think what the Indians would really like is to be able to sell to the Americans. And I think there's also a hope from the American side to be able to build on the trade, build on the money. There's billions of dollars in military hardware that India wants to buy right now. And I think companies in the United States are hoping to get a slice of that pie for sure.
What about the concern that President Obama has complained long and loudly, particularly recently, about outsourcing of jobs from the United States?
Yeah, that's definitely a sore point. But I think it's a really small sore point right now because, as I mentioned, there's so much money here at the moment. There is actually Indian companies poaching American workers. They're thinking of going into campuses in America to recruit young people to come and work over here. So I think the outsourcing issue, to some in the IT industry, it might be a sore point, but I think for others, it's really a non-issue now in terms of the bigger picture and what India can really bring to the table.
India recruiting from the U.S., I understand that a lot of Indians who have come to the United States and been especially important in IT, as you mentioned, are now going back to India.
Exactly. I mean, many of the second-generation Indian Americans who are over there have been coming back here, or have been coming here, I should say. They've never actually lived in this country, and they've been coming back, taking up jobs. There's a real sort of skills shortage. But I've been meeting American Americans. I met a young man the other day. He's a 27-year-old engineer from. He's not an engineer. He's in real estate, and he never left the D.C. area. 2 years ago, he came here, got a job as a consultant in an equity firm, and is loving it. He's loving it. And he's just a small, growing number of Americans who are actually coming to India and looking for work.
Tinku Ray, again in Delhi. You can hear the fireworks behind her, as she indicated, celebrating Diwali. No fireworks, though, in Mumbai, where the president is going to arrive. tomorrow. Gunjan Bagla is managing director of Amrit. That's a consultancy in Southern California which helps Americans do business in India. He's also author of the book Doing Business in 21st Century India. He's currently in Mumbai. He's part of the Presidential Executive Mission. That's a trade group organized by the U.S.-India Business Council, not just directly part of the president's entourage. Gunjan Bagla, thanks a lot for being on our program.
Thank you so much, Warren. Can you hear me? I'm just walking into the Trident Hotel as I speak. Can you hear me all right?
We can hear you perfectly, and thanks again for being on our program today.
Thank you so much. The Trident is, of course, the site where the, you know, one of the sites where the terrorists attacked in November 2008, and immense security here. So I'm delighted to be on the show.
Tell us a little bit more about the security you're seeing there.
Well, South Bombay is where the president will be staying. He arrived tomorrow morning, and as my car entered the hotel premises, they check your the engine, they check the trunk, they check inside to be sure that everything is okay, and we expect the entire hotel to be under lockdown starting about 2 p.m. tomorrow. The president will be staying about a quarter mile from where I am staying, but all the events tomorrow will be at this hotel. There's a very festive atmosphere at the same time, however, Warren, because not only is it Diwali, as the previous caller talked about, it is also the day when the Indian stock market has hit the highest ever. The Sensex crossed 20,000 yesterday.
Wow. Earlier we heard from Tinku Ray with the BBC that India really feels that it has the upper hand in this relationship, especially with a growth rate of more than 8%, where the United States is 2%. Do you agree with that? You're doing business, or you're living now in Southern California. Have things changed that much between these two countries?
Yes, they've changed dramatically in the last 10 years and quite a bit in the last 2 years as well. One reason why I think you would feel this imbalance in the relationship is that Indians generally, Indian executives and Indian leaders, politicians, understand America much better than American politicians and business leaders understand India. Most Indian politicians and business leaders have traveled many times to the United States. They often have relatives who live here, who live in the U.S. And so they have a much better appreciation of what might be going on inside an American's mind. The reverse, unfortunately, is not true. And so you have this imbalance about, and that makes it possible for Indian executives to be more successful in America than vice versa. That's some of the frustration I think we are going to see play out in the next couple of days as the president and his team arrive here in Mumbai.
What's in this visit for the United States? What do you think President Obama and the contingent that he's bringing with him, 250 people, including the Secretary of Commerce, what do you think they want to get out of it?
Well, for the president and the executive mission, it's really about business and about jobs. India is ready and interested in buying really all things American. One of the key areas of focus is defense purchases. 90% of India's hardware today is Russian or Soviet in origin. And today, India is ready and willing and has the money to buy American military hardware, including the C-17 Globemaster aircraft that will be manufactured right in Long Beach, right in Southern California, where you and I live. There's been some obstacles around that, primarily around American export controls that have made it difficult for the large defense suppliers to provide the latest platforms that India wants to buy. And India isn't happy to buy obsolete or old technology because they can get the latest from the Russians, the French, and the Israelis.
So India really then is in a position to bargain.
Absolutely, absolutely. We saw that last month when India's defense minister came to Washington, talked about American purchases, and shortly after that announced two large deals with the Russians. One could be as much as $25 billion for what they call the fifth-generation fighter aircraft. And they did this fully aware that President Obama was going to arrive in India shortly after. And I think that it's part of a negotiating position to let the American government know that India does have choices.
The leadership of India was early to visit the Obama White House, but there's a lot being written to the effect that India does not feel as confident with President Obama as they did with either George W. Bush or President Clinton. Do you think that's true?
Well, there's a couple of factors at play. One is around the issue of free trade and what we in the U.S. worry about relative to outsourcing. When President Obama was running his campaign, he talked about how American tax law should not favor outsourcing. And this has set a little bit of a worry on the minds of Indian executives that perhaps the administration will clamp down on free trade. It really hasn't happened. But there is another worry that I think is more significant, and it was driven by the American administration's preoccupation with domestic issues as President Obama came to power, but also with the continued funneling of American money into Pakistan. Most of that goes to support the Afghani effort, since 90% of American supplies into Afghanistan flow through Pakistan. But much of that money eventually makes it into the wrong hands in Pakistan, and that's been a worry for India for many years, but has been accentuated as the Afghan effort has grown.
Gunjan Bagla, once again, director of AMRID, a consultancy in Southern California, author of Doing Business in 21st Century India. Let me go back to Tinku Ray with the BBC in Delhi. You host a program called World Briefing. Very quickly, if you can, because we're short of time, you know what that means in broadcasting. What about India's relationships, not just with Pakistan, but also with China and other countries in that region? Are they going to be important during the president's visit?
Yes, definitely, Warren. And I think those are issues that the Indian side will want to raise with the president. Mr. Bagla mentioned the whole issue of military aid that is given to Pakistan from the United States, which is the effort for the fight against terrorism. Pakistan plays a pivotal role in that fight, of course. But they are worried. The Indians are very worried about that aid going to these extremist groups that have carried out attacks in India. But India is also trying to grow, you know, sort of trying to make its relationship with China better. And I think it really wants the United States' help in sort of becoming a more regional dominating power in this area to sort of keep any of these countries at abeyance from attacking or sort of coming down on India.
A couple of seconds left. Do many Indians think that Pakistan was responsible for the attack in Mumbai?
I think overwhelmingly, yes, definitely, Warren. And I think the Indian government has shown a lot of evidence on to prove that as well.
Okay, Tinku Ray with the BBC in Delhi, Gunjan Bagla from Southern California, currently in Mumbai. Thank you both very much for being on our program today. We're going to continue this conversation after a brief break on Reporter's Notebook, the genome and personalized medicine. Tell us what you think on our To the Point Facebook page. Back in a moment with To the Point from PRI.
A complete archive of past programs is available online at kcrw.com/to the point. You can also order a CD copy by calling 1-888-600-5279.
Warren Ali back with To the Point. Once again, President Obama will arrive in India tomorrow. He'll be there until at least Monday when he addresses the Indian Parliament. He's, of course, going to other countries as well, but India is the one that we are focusing on today. I should just mention that Gunjan Bagla was in Mumbai, and you could hear the fireworks, the Diwali fireworks going behind him at that point. Apparently, it's just around the area where there's the most security that they aren't allowed, even today, which is Diwali. Obviously, there won't be anything like that tomorrow. Here's a bit of what the president had to say as he was leaving and talking to reporters about his trip.
Our prosperity depends not just on consuming things, but also on being the maker of things. In fact, for every $1 billion we increase in exports, thousands of jobs are supported here at home. And that's why I've set a goal of doubling America's exports over the next 5 years. And that's why, on the trip that I'm about to take, I'm going to be talking about opening up additional markets in places like India, so that American businesses can sell more products abroad in order to create more jobs here at home.
Again, the president before leaving on his trip. Paula Newberg is director of the Institute for the Study of Diplomacy at Georgetown University. She specializes in South Asian issues, and she's a familiar voice on our program. Thanks a lot for joining us once again.
Well, good afternoon.
Obviously, the president's talking about a kind of balance between outsourcing, which he complained about a lot during the recent election campaigns, and developing markets overseas. How important a part of his trip is that?
I assume it's quite important. This is not an area in which I specialize particularly, but certainly the way in which some of these issues arose in the election campaigns, whether accurately or not, has made the creation of a balance in his presentation all the more important for the year coming forward.
Let's talk a little bit about international diplomacy. We just heard from Tinku Ray with the BBC in Delhi that most people in India still believe that it was Pakistan that was behind the attacks in Mumbai. What about relations between India and Pakistan, particularly now that the United States is pouring money in there in the interests of trying to improve the situation in Afghanistan?
This is a question with a many-part answer. I guess I would start off by saying that it's been interesting to watch the Pakistani press on this issue. It's been relatively quiet on the question of Obama going to India. You know, very little in the way of commentary. Very much an assumption that President Obama's notion that India is the linchpin of its South Asia, of the U.S. South Asia policy is really true, even if the Pakistanis would prefer to not to believe so. So that's the first thing. The second is, it is likely that the Pakistan agenda on regional security right now has much more to do with a focus on the way in which Afghanistan does or does not figure in America's plans, with Pakistan as the kind of the dependent variable. So although India-Pakistan relations are always percolating along at a fairly high level, in terms of what counts as a decision moment for the Obama administration, the Pakistan-Afghanistan relationship is probably a bit more important just now.
Aren't the Pakistanis very worried about the relationship between India and Afghanistan?
Yes, they are. But a lot of this has to do with the degree to which the United States and NATO does or does not maintain a presence in Afghanistan. The relationship goes in two different ways. One, the Indians have played a very interesting role in Afghanistan since 2002, and the Pakistanis have objected vociferously at various periods of time. On the other hand, if NATO and the United States leave quickly and in a large way, then I think there are those in India who have a suspicion that they will be called upon to play a larger role in India to balance off the Pakistani influence, and that leaves the Pakistanis worried that they might have a kind of Indian pincer effect with Pakistan left in the middle. Now, none of this has been articulated in a terribly detailed way in any public conversations, but it does affect the tenor of the way in which this visit and future U.S.-Indian relations are seen in Pakistan.
So would you expect, then, the president and the leaders of India to be talking about Kashmir?
I expect that that's a separate subject. The United States, again, has played this in a rather interesting way. When President Obama was campaigning, he suggested that Kashmir should be settled. There should be a special envoy to settle this issue with those in South Asia, and the Indians rejected this out of hand. The United States backtracked considerably. Similarly, when Ambassador Holbrooke was made a special envoy for the region, and the first articulated assumptions were that he would have something to do with India, again, the Indians objected, and the United States backtracked. So at this point, the United States is in a rather interesting situation, insofar as, on the whole, the United States is supposed to object to what appear to be the violation of human rights overseas. On the other hand, and the Indians have claimed Kashmir to be a matter of domestic importance, but not international importance. The Pakistanis, for their part, keep saying that if Kashmir were settled, all would be fine between Pakistan and India, and I don't think anyone really believes that any longer.
We heard earlier on the program that India believes that it has the upper hand now in the relationship with the United States, particularly from an economic standpoint, in as much as India's economy is growing by more than 8%. The United States economy is growing by less than or roughly 2%. Paula Newberg, do you think that India feels it has the upper hand on the United States in other ways as well, in terms of the geopolitical situation and America's influence in South Asia?
The Indian government has every reason to believe that its own success at home becomes a stepping stone toward greater influence globally. They probably have relatively good reason to believe that the disarray in Pakistan, due to weak governance and an extremely weak economy, as well as Pakistan's relationship to Afghanistan, makes Pakistan a much less important player in Indian eyes. And I think that is probably true. The role that Pakistan plays in the United States' mind is as much one of a helper, but a dependent helper, in Afghanistan, and otherwise something of a trial, because Pakistan has such difficulty working out how to govern itself, how to pay for itself, and how to move forward in ways that even remotely parallel what India has been able to do in recent years.
So what do you think of the major issues the president is concerned about? What would be what would constitute a successful visit there?
I have no doubt that the administration believes that one major marker of a successful visit to Pakistan, to India this time, will be the commercial side. And that's the reason for the delegation looking as heavily commercial as it is. The American companies have learned over the last few years to treat Indian companies with a good deal of respect, and indeed Indian companies in many ways are a source of profit in trade now. Secondly, the Indian economy has done far better in the global downturn than even the United States has done in the last couple of years. So it becomes an anchor of strength. I expect there will be important conversations, although not ones made terribly public, about regional security arrangements. And that will include Pakistan-Afghanistan, Pakistan-India, and I think a back burner kind of question on Kashmir.
What about, let me go to our next guest and ask the next question. Paula Newberg, once again, is director of the Institute for the Study of Diplomacy at Georgetown University. Ashley Tellis is a senior associate at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. He specializes in Asian strategic issues. He was a senior advisor in the State Department during President Bush's second term, and he helped to negotiate the civil nuclear agreement with India. Ashley Tellis, good to have you in our program.
Thank you, Warren.
I was going to ask about relations with China, but let me ask you first about the nuclear agreement. How important was it, and are there aspects of it that still have to be completed?
Well, the nuclear agreement was very important because it got off the table what was a bilateral disagreement that persisted for almost about 30 years. I think most of the work has now been done. The last remaining issue is reconciling India's recent liability legislation with the evolving international norm, which is codified in the compensation, the supplementary compensation protocol. This is an issue that we haven't quite closed on yet, and I think both sides will have some very serious conversations about this while the president is in Delhi.
It sounds like a rather technical matter, but explain, if you will, as best you can to our lay audience, what it means. Whose liability are we talking about?
Well, the Convention on Supplementary Compensation is a protocol that basically says all liability in the event of a nuclear accident should rest with the operator of the plant and not with any of the suppliers who've produced or offered the equipment. The Indian legislation is interesting because it makes the operator the nodal point for liability, but it gives the operator the right to seek redress in a court of law against suppliers. And so that obviously is at variance with the evolving international norm.
Now, go ahead.
This is of particular concern to the U.S. because American companies are private companies, unlike French companies or Russian companies, which are either parastatals or wholly owned state companies. And so American companies are particularly vulnerable under the terms of the Indian law. And so President Obama has made this a priority to find ways of getting India to modify its legislation or find some regulatory solutions that level the playing field for American companies.
So the U.S. wants to protect the suppliers rather than the operators.
That is correct. It wants to protect suppliers because that is what the international norm is all about.
And how likely is this to be resolved? You said it sounded as if it was going along fairly well.
I think it's not likely to be resolved with any finality right now, but I think there will be a solution that will hopefully be made public during the visit. Both sides have been involved in quite intense negotiations on this, and I'm optimistic that we will find a way forward.
So this is important to the commercial aspects of things that Paula Neuberg just said were probably the major reasons for the trip, because there's a lot of money in nuclear supply.
That's exactly right. And India is, you know, looking to expand its nuclear sector very substantially over the next two or three decades. And American companies are eagerly looking to play a part in that expansion. But unless the legislation is corrected to rectify these anomalies, there is a chance that, you know, American companies may have to sit this one out. And that won't go down well either with the commercial side in the U.S. or with the government.
Are there in India any of the kinds of concerns there are here in the United States about nuclear power, about waste disposal, about the devastating nature of a nuclear accident, should one in fact occur? Or are they going ahead full steam with, I guess that's the right metaphor, with nuclear power?
Well, I think both sides of the equation, in a sense, are true. The Indians are concerned about the prospects of accident. They had a very serious accident, not involving a nuclear plant, but a chemical plant in Bhopal,
yes,
about 30 years ago. So they understand what catastrophic industrial accidents mean. But on the other hand, they have huge developmental needs. And being able to meet the demands of electricity have put them in a position where they really don't have a choice but to invest in nuclear electricity, among other sources of supply. So it's a question of managing, you know, what is a very difficult dilemma.
Well, now we've talked about India's relationships with Pakistan and Afghanistan. What about China? And they're all concerned, of course, about China. But what particularly are the issues between India and China? And how does the U.S. fit in, the U.S. that wanting to maintain its presence in that part of the world?
Well, the India-China relationship is a very delicate and a very fraught relationship. There are outstanding political disputes about the border. There are all manner of military rivalries between the two countries. And both sides see themselves as, in a sense, natural competitors in Asia. What has developed in the last few years is, interestingly, now new forms of commercial competition. Because the Chinese have a very burgeoning trade relationship with India, but most of it is focused on importing Indian raw materials. China has been reluctant to give Indian manufacturing companies as much access as they would like to the Chinese market. So in addition to the old political problems, you now have new commercial problems. In fact, it's not realized often, but India has the largest number of anti-dumping cases that has been filed in the WTO against China. And so you have now a combination of both economic and political rivalry. And the United States kind of, you know, sits squarely in between because we play on both dimensions. Issues relating to an undervalued Chinese currency are of concern to India. They're also of concern to the United States. The way in which China protects access to its markets is, again, a common issue between India and the United States. And, of course, the old political problems of, you know, how does China use its power in Asia is, again, a common concern to both countries. So there's enough there to keep the two, to keep India and the United States at least having a decent conversation.
With India growing so fast and becoming competitive with China in so many ways, where does that leave the United States?
Well, I don't think it leaves the United States terribly worse off, to be honest. I think at this moment we are having a difficult period that we are obviously going through. But if you look at the larger, you know, if you look at it in larger perspective, the U.S. economy still has, you know, tremendous strengths. It's a high innovation economy. It has a very educated workforce. It has a large workforce. And it has to manage, most of all, really, its manner of capital formation. We save too little. We spend too much. If we can fix that, I think native strengths of the American economy, particularly in terms of its innovation and its labor pool, will really assert itself over time. And so when one looks out into the out years, I'm not particularly pessimistic that the U.S. is going to be in a terribly disadvantaged position vis-a-vis both these countries.
Ashley, tell us, formerly with the State Department, now at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Paula Neuberg, back to you at Georgetown University. Are you fairly optimistic about America's role in that part of the world?
Yes, I am. I think I would go along with Ashley, and I say this with some hope, that what can count as our domestic economic strengths will be able to make it possible for us to pursue a reasonable, balanced, fair, and dynamic relationship in Asia. I would say, however, that there are ways of looking at Asia such that you separate those that are weak and those that are strong. What Ashley is talking about to some large degree is relationships with China and with India. There are quite a number of weak states that surround those two countries, and that's where problems have arisen before, and those are the places to keep a clear eye on for the future.
Well, Paula Neuberg at the Institute for the Study of Diplomacy at Georgetown University, thanks so much to you, and thanks again to Ashley Tellis as well. One more question to Gunjang Bagla, who was going through security as we talked to him earlier at his hotel in Mumbai. Just very briefly, if you will, what are the first meetings? Who's going to be there? When will they take place? What do you expect?
Well, the first substantive meeting is here in Mumbai tomorrow afternoon, where the delegation of the U.S.-India Business Council and some of the leaders of Indian industry will discuss how to create a win-win situation between the two countries as far as business goes. And at the end of that discussion, President Obama will deliver the keynote address. So that's the main event today on Saturday. And then it's not clear what he'll be doing on Sunday. He goes on to Delhi for political discussions on Monday.
So then will he be touring around at all in Mumbai? Again, there's so much security concern there, obviously. You had to come through it when you were talking to us before. How much do you think he'll range around? We did hear he was going to the Gandhi Museum.
Yes, he has a few appointments besides this business meeting. He's going to visit the Gandhi Museum. He's going to visit a site where some of the people, a memorial to some of those who died at the hands of the terrorists. And he's going to, as he always does, speak to a group of students at St. Xavier's College here in Mumbai. Those are the events that have been announced. I think there's a private meeting with some of the top executives of the largest Indian companies earlier in the day.
And do you think it's important that he's going to Mumbai first, the commercial and entertainment capital of India, rather than going to Delhi to talk about politics and international relations?
Absolutely, Warren. I think that makes a very important statement. This is exactly what Secretary Hillary Clinton did when she came to India in July. She, too, July of last year, she stayed at the Taj Hotel. She met with the captains of industry before going on to New Delhi. I think it sets the right tone, and the president is astute to do that. The business relationship that is being built between the two countries is a win-win relationship. It's one that both the people of both countries gain, and there's very little controversy compared to, say, what has happened with China over the last number of years. One quick point I wanted to add that we haven't covered, Warren, is
quickly,
that...
Quickly, we're running short of time. Go ahead.
Yeah, Indian companies are investing in the United States. In fact, right in Southern California, Steven Spielberg took in $300 million from billionaire Anil Ambani right here from Bombay, and there are many such examples of Indian companies putting money into the United States. So it's a bilateral relationship.
Well, thank you so much for being with us again from Mumbai as the president is about to arrive there. Gunjan Bagla with Amrit in Southern California, also author of Doing Business in 21st Century India. Thanks to all of our other guests as well once again. It took $2 billion and 10 years to complete the Human Genome Project. Two people had their genomes analyzed during that time. Now, just 10 years later, many individuals have had their genomes sequenced, and the cost keeps dropping. In a moment, we'll talk about the future of personalized medicine. In a moment on To the Point.
For more information about To the Point or to sign up for the free podcast, visit kcrw.com/To the Point.
Warren Olney back with Reporter's Notebook on To the Point. Kevin Davis is editor of BioIT World, which covers the role of technology in the life sciences. He's also author of The $1,000 Genome, The Revolution in DNA Sequencing, and The New Era of Personalized Medicine. Thank you very much for being on our program.
I'm delighted to be here. Thanks.
We don't have a lot of time for a very complex and fascinating story. Let this be an introduction to the subject. We'll have you back on a later program. But in the meantime, $1,000 genome, is it really down to that?
It's almost down to that, yeah. I mean, there's tens of thousands of people have already used the services of a consumer genomics company like a 23andMe in San Francisco or a Pathway Genomics in San Diego, which gives you a quick approximation and tells you a lot of information about your health traits and conditions as well as your ancestry. But there are now companies, including Illumina in San Diego, so it's all happening in your neck of the woods, which can offer a complete genome sequence to anybody who wants one. All you need is a doctor's note and a check for a little under $20,000. I know that still sounds like a ridiculous amount of money, and in some ways it is, but when you think that the first personal genome was just a few years ago and it cost $1 million, and the Human Genome Project 10 years ago cost billions of dollars, you can see how amazingly quickly the price is dropping. I think the $1,000 genome will be with us in just a couple of years.
Okay, what do you get from it? Be a little more specific.
Yeah, well, you get your full DNA sequence. That's 6 billion letters or units of DNA. And from that, scientists and doctors can glean an increasing amount of information. Every week, more and more discoveries and associations are made about specific genes and DNA markers that are associated and can tell you your risk of a whole host of common diseases, from diabetes to obesity to different cancers. This information is still preliminary. I must say, this isn't a black and white, you will get cancer X at age 45. We're nowhere near that level of certainty. But nevertheless, a lot of people are finding very useful, in some cases life-changing information, and I give a number of examples in the $1,000 genome in my book, including a guy who, a biotech executive, who ended up having prostate cancer because of what his DNA told him. He had no other signs of the disease. He's under 50. It's a radical surgery, but life-changing surgery, basically because he spat in a cup and sent his saliva off to be analyzed.
Now, there are other issues that will arise, undoubtedly, having to do, for example, with whether insurance companies get the information.
Yeah. Well, thankfully, we have a new legislation. It's 2 years old. President Bush signed it into law, called GINA, the Genetic Information and Non-Discrimination Act. And that does provide very good safeguards, most experts conclude, for any discrimination by your employer or your health insurance company. So people can, you know, be fairly safe in the knowledge that we have that protection. That doesn't mean that an employer won't try and let you go if they don't like the fact that you've had a genetic test. And there's at least one case that I'm aware of where a woman is suing her former employer under GINA because she believes she was wrongfully terminated because she had the nerve to have a breast cancer gene test, for example.
Why has the price dropped so low so fast?
Yeah, I spent a fair bit of time in the book talking about this. Amazing new technologies that have just burst on the scene in the last 4 or 5 years. Companies like 454, Illumina, Life Technologies, have taken new chemistries and miniaturized DNA sequencing and developed new technologies such that the speed of being able to analyze one's DNA sequence is increasing faster than the speed that your computers are improving year upon year. It is many people think this is the fastest growing sort of technology segment of any in the sciences at the moment. It's been quite spectacular, and it's not stopped yet. There are new technologies. Pacific Biosciences in San Francisco just went public last week. Another company called Complete Genomics in the Bay Area is going public next week. These companies are going to, you know, take us to a whole new level of price and performance.
What is meant by personalized medicine?
Yeah, it's the idea that our DNA doesn't tell us everything, but we all, I think, anecdotally know that we respond differently to different drugs, and there may be clues in our genetic makeup to whether we're likely to get diabetes or cancer or Parkinson's disease or Alzheimer's disease. And so drug companies, ever since, you know, the Human Genome Project was completed 10 years ago, have had this sort of dream, this notion that we can personalize diagnostics and therapy. We're seeing early signs of this happening, particularly in the field of cancer, where doctors are able to look at specific genes and say, you know what, patient A isn't going to respond to this drug. We won't try that therapy and waste all that money on them. But patient B is a good candidate to respond. And I think whole genome sequencing, personal genome analysis, is going to be part and parcel of this, not only for drugs that are on the market, but as pharma companies try and put new drugs into clinical trials, this sort of technology is going to help them tease out which patients are going to respond and which aren't going to respond.
Does it work both ways? As there's more personal genome sequencing, will there be knowledge gathered that will apply to everybody?
Oh, undoubtedly. I mean, I think people have always said one human genome project was never going to be enough. A report in a leading science magazine, Nature magazine, just last week tallied every human genome that's been sequenced so far, or by the end of this year. The tally was put at about 2,700. These aren't just personal genomes like Glenn Close and Ozzy Osbourne, the former singer of Black Sabbath that you might have heard about.
Sure.
But companies like Complete have sequenced hundreds of people, individuals, for pharma companies and different clients, and there's a lot going on in China and Hong Kong as well. This some knowledge is going to provide and identify new cancer genes, new genes for Alzheimer's and all kinds of diseases, and it's a very bright future for personal and genomic medicine.
Kevin Davis, the book is The $1,000 Genome, The Revolution in DNA Sequencing and the New Era of Personalized Medicine. He's also editor-in-chief of BioIT World. Thanks a lot.
Thank you for having me on.
Producers of To The Point, Francis Anderton, Christian Bordahl, Andrea Brody, Katie Cooper, Sonia Geis, and Gary Scott, our technical director, Mike Newport, managing producer, Cameron Radziner. Thanks to the John Coltrane family. Email us, share your thoughts on our comment page, kcrw.com/To The Point. I'm Warren Olney. Join us again for To The Point, produced live and podcast as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and PRI.
PRI, Public Radio International.